Hello. So, a lot of technical people and developers and stuff like that. And so we want to show a bit what we've done in the basically last 12 years or something like that with our project and how we became Gimp maintainers and everything, this kind of stuff. So it started. So basically we're doing Libart, but especially I'm mostly speaking on behalf of Arium here, who is doing most of the stuff, and I do technical stuff. So that's, for instance, that was next up from a project. There is no sound.
They call me the Firefox.
Well, this one was done with Photoshop because Arium was working as a film director, and like we made like this small contest of Mozilla Foundation was doing back
Firefox
in 2012, and we won one prize on this. So after this, we made this a small video. They asked us like some kind of made
Thank
some
you for
this one
us.
Was made
Tell
with GIMP.
Us, why did you okay. participate in Flix?
So this was probably in 2013.
Well, you see,
so
because we of were, Mozilla. They do the same.
It was one of the first tests where Arium was basically testing GIMP. Could it be actually used for professional stuff? So this kind of stuff. So that was also like some early experiments were also made with GIMP, like trying to animate images in GIMP. And
jamais 203.
Yeah, that was this kind of stuff, like at the very start. Back then, we were even doing the music ourselves
Ooh
and
la
everything.
La.
Harmonica, me, and Arium guitar or piano or stuff like that. So, this kind of stuff. At some point, we were trying to see, like, oh, I even did like a crowdfunding for code for like implementing so that's pixelation. This is stop motion with human beings. I hit a bit people's face. So that was also an experiment. Photo is taken with Entangle, which is a free software for tethering, photo tethering. I contributed a bit to this for doing stuff for stop motion with this. And all the editing part was GIMP, this kind of stuff. So. Yeah, and like early, I think 2013, I made my first small crowdfunding where I implemented symmetry painting in GIMP back then. It did work. This kind of stuff was another experiment. So early, like for this is a rotoscopy, so actual dancer dancing. So it was a project with a dancer, and she was dancing, and I am rotoscopy everything also on GIMP, of course. So, this kind of stuff. Like, basically, there were a lot of experiments first, like, there were a lot of issues. That's also why we're starting. They were like, probably the first time we tried to plug a tablet on GIMP, there was no hot plug. We did not know about this, GIMP crash, of course. So, that was also one of the early fixes we did back then, and this kind of stuff. At some point, we went to France because, yeah, before this, we were in various countries and went to France. And tried with a non-profit, we can started with a non-profit, and we made like a small Libre Caranda thing where with other artists. Well, that's another fun stuff we did. Like that's a 4x4 page of which is SMIL animation, except that back then there was no free software doing SMIL animation, so it was made in Inkscape and edited by hand for the animation. Well, that's kind of workshop we did in various libraries in Paris. Also pixelations with kids, and this kind of workshop had a great success because we don't like to put kids in front of computers when they ask us, oh, do we want to do animation workshop, but that's not cool. So for kids, we do this kind of thing. It really explains them how do movies work, you know? So I actually do this, and I had small script, I had Entangle also, and like I could immediately give them the file immediately after. I just click on the button, and after like every session, they had like five or six small animations like this in 1 hour. So this kind of stuff. And like, yeah, for the Free Software Foundation, at some point, they commissioned us to do some enamel pins. So of course, it's a bit of GIMP for the design, Inkscape, Scribus, and everything. And I'm not putting everything because I removed some of the non-free software stuff. We also did some stuff for some production, like that's emoticons for like Movim. It's one of the social network, free software social network stuff. They asked, they also commissioned us, like, do you want to do emoticons? They had this stuff of emoticon collection, this kind of stuff. So a lot of that stuff, we started to get some money from some. This one is actually a nice commission for a very big nonprofit in France called Les Petits Frères des Pauvres, which was helping old people with not a lot of income and stuff. So we made a movie with people, also interviews of volunteers, and we also made a board game for the volunteers. We just wanted some kind of board game to onboard new volunteers in the big nonprofit. So a lot of Inkscape and laser printing and cutting and everything, and this kind of stuff. And that was also a nice project, two nice projects, the animation with cameraman. And that was commissioned for
YouTube or Vimeo. You
for Framasoft. So and upload maybe a lot of people know Framasoft. It's a non-profit.
What is the Fediverse?
So it's actually commissioned us for two stuff. What is Twitter? What is the Fediverse? That's two videos. You can see the longer one, the full version on the internet. This kind of stuff. Like that was like for someone was doing a video game, which is some kind of Bomberman like video game, and made characters and stuff like that. And I mean, Arium made them. It's always Arium. Yeah, I just code. So this kind of stuff. And and this is our biggest project, and it's been many years. And we are crowdfunding for this. So it's an animation film which is about 11 minutes. And it's all made in GIMP also, of course. So that's just one small excerpt. And that's our main thing for which we get crowdfunding for many years. And people are, we have like 1,000 people funding us. It started very low, and more it goes up. So and like everybody's paid. For this, that's also one of the points. We want the artists and everything, even musicians, they are paid, well paid and everything. Actually, last year in LGM, we had a small ciné concert, a concert with this in the background with three musicians, and it was unfinished work, and we redid it with a bit more finished in Fosdem in January. So that was on, we are like a keynote on the big stage. So and three musicians will came to Fosdem. So it's the same. I just put the same scene again, right? And again, like the musicians are paid when they come here, because that's really what we want. That's what our non-profit does, and like showing that Libat is free software and Libat, right? So this will be all available on internet, and even the source we will upload them, and people just can edit whatever, re-edit, and that's a whole concept. And so it's also like musicians and artists and everybody and developers, everybody gets paid for working on doing actually, but so yeah, and I don't show everything. I just show like the most like free software related stuff. Like and one of the big stuff is of course along these years we contributed more and more to GIMP. Until at some point we became the biggest contributors, so now we're also co-maintainers of GIMP. This logo actually is the new logo is also Arium who made it, and most of the stuff which I've developed are designed by Arium basically. So Arium is the main basic designer of GIMP these days. So that's it.
So thanks for the technical support.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sebastian Fiebach. I'm a computer science student, and together with Anna and Sebastian Bachmann, who unfortunately can't be here with us today, we are the user group LibreGraphics Vienna, which is a user group for free and open source graphics, art, and photography software based in Vienna. And we regularly meet at a hackspace in Vienna's first district. It's called the Meta Lab. It's actually one of the oldest hackspaces around. It's at a very central location. It's very easy to reach by public transport, and the community is really great. There's a ton of infrastructure. So that's our location. And when we meet, which happens about every month, we usually do workshops on different graphics and photography related topics. Here's a bit of an overview of what we did in the past. So there were a lot of photography workshops, especially Anna and Sebastian Bachmann made these about RAW editing, like using RAW therapy or Darktable, promoting your work on the web through the Fediverse or self-hosted photo galleries. Display calibration, very important topic, unfortunately a bit overlooked, and also stuff like vector graphics. And recently I joined in with doing a workshop on Krita and digital painting. And next, Anna will tell you about how it all started, the history of the user group, and the challenges that we are also currently facing.
Okay, thank you. So, can you hear me? Yes. So, everything started a little more than 2 years ago. In February 2023, I decided to go to a local Debian user group, which was held at the Meta Lab. I had been to those meetings before COVID, and they were usually quite nice. There were between five and between 5 and 30 participants. There was a talk, and after that a discussion, and sometimes there were even women. And so I decided to go to that meeting again in February 2023. And I went to the Meta Lab, and I was like almost an hour late. I arrived at 7 p.m. Around 7 p.m., the official starting time was supposed to be at 6 p.m. And I arrived there, and nobody was there. There were, of course, people around, because there are always people at the Meta Lab, but nobody of them had actually come to the Debian meetup. And so I sat down and waited a bit, and after about 30 minutes, a young man arrived and asked whether anybody had come to the Debian meetup, and I said, yes, okay, that's me. So yes, and we started to talk, and we very soon discovered that we were both photographers, more precisely landscape and nature photographers, and that we both used Darktable. And so we talked and discussed, and I talked about Sigmoid, which was new back then in Darktable. And as it turned out, as I said, there were already people around. They had not come to the Debiana meetup, but they happened to be interested in photography. There was at least one analog photographer and at least one astrophotographer. And so they joined our discussion, and so it looked like the Debian meetup had actually become a photography meetup. And I also wanted to, I forgot to mention that the young man who came to the Debian meetup, that was, of course, Sebastian Bachmann. Yeah, that's him. He is a scientist at the Technical University of Vienna. And at the time when we met for the first time, he was about to finish his doctoral studies. I think he wrote his thesis about computer-aided bone analysis. Yes, and so eventually, around 9 p.m., I think the organizer of the Debian meetup arrived. And sometime later, another Debian guy arrived, and by that time it was almost 10 p.m., and for most of us it was already time to go. And so, yeah, we went home. Some of us went home. I don't know what the others did. And so the next day I was really annoyed because I didn't know how to contact Sebastian. We had not actually exchanged any contact details. But only a few hours later, I got a message from Sebastian via pixels.us, because apparently he had searched, he had looked for me, and he found me because I have an easy-to-remember nickname. And so in his message, he suggested that we found a Darktable, a local Darktable user group. And so, of course, I was very happy, and I said, yes, let's do it. And so... yes, the first meeting was about 1 month later in March 2023, and it was about Darktable, and there were about six participants, I think, yes. And that's how everything started, and I also want to mention that the Debian Treff, the Debian user group, does not exist anymore. Unfortunately, I think it died during the fall and the winter 2023. Yes, that's how it started. And I think the next slide, please. Since then, we've had about 16 or 17 meetings, so not exactly one per month, because we usually, in the summer, we usually have a break. And so some of them were quite successful. Among the most popular topics were astrophotography, Cyril, of course, Darktable. Also, very popular meetups were self-hosted web galleries and social media and the Fediverse for artists and photographers. These were the most popular meetups. But I don't want to lie. We are struggling a bit with the number of the participants. What is normal are 4 to 5 participants, including the speaker and the sponsor. And that's normal. If we have 4 or 5 people, we are already happy. The more popular meetings were astrophotography and social media, and that were, I think, the maximum number of participants was about 10, but those meetings, I must say, I don't necessarily want more than 10 or 15 people, because then you can't have a good discussion anymore. But those meetings were really great, and as I prepared for this lightning talk, I realized that we had actually more popular and fun meetings than rather disappointing meetings. Under the disappointing topics were, no surprise, calibration. Unfortunately, also Vulkan Darktable and, surprisingly, Inkscape. We had 2 Inkscape meetings, and on one of them there were 3 participants, and on the other one only Sebastian and me. So that's it, and we had quite an interesting discussion about this. On pixels.us, as you can see on the slide, Sebastian posed the questions. He actually only wanted to find out which topics do the people actually want. And that became an interesting discussion, and we discovered that the number of participants is actually directly related with the phenomenon of the disappearing of the third spaces. I don't know, do you know what that means? Do you know what that, yes. Okay, I'm trying to explain. In short, it's the disappearing, it means that social media and the internet have taken the place of former so-called third spaces, which means people don't go anymore to in-person meetings, user groups, hobbyist groups, photography groups, etc., etc. They are living with their smartphones and in their smartphones and in the internet. And I think this very very conference is also struggling with that a bit. So I think that's it. Yeah.
So just to wrap this up, this is where you can find us at liberategraphicsvienna.at or on the Fediverse at lgb@fedi.at. We'd be really happy to meet some of you in Vienna. I don't think we have time for questions, unfortunately. But thanks for your attention.
Yeah, one more thing. We are looking not only for listeners, participants, but also for speakers. So if you happen to travel to Vienna, please contact us and give a talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mark Alexandru is next. So, and he has not a slideshow, so yeah. This will be a quick changeover.
Just speaking. hi, everyone. I assume like everyone knows about like why open source matters here, and you know people always say it's always about like giving autonomy, freedom, and like most importantly, you get to own what is on your computer. But today, I just wanted to like give you a different perspective, one that I've been learning over the past few years, on why open source matters, and especially this is quite relevant towards libographics. So last semester, I took a class called Authors and Genres with Dr. Jason Query. I'll say hi to the camera, because I'm sure he'll watch it afterwards. And part of it was about what authors and how authors have authorship in film. After all, I'm a film student. So what is authorship? So to give a brief kind of overview on auteur theory, we have to kind of go back. So the crash course is basically François Truffaut, famous film director. Before that, he was a film critic, and he kind of attacked literary adaptations of film, saying that film, those kinds of films are just like copying the literary qualities, and so the director isn't actually good. And so he kind of started sparking some discussion in Europe about what is a good film, and the kind of argument was that good directors are the ones who kind of can give a certain aesthetic that is repeated over time. So like think of like Hitchcock, he might have a certain style that is recognizable, and so therefore he is a good author. And later on in American Critique, Andrew Saris kind of looked at all this and said, okay, this is auteur theory, and he kind of came up with a list of directors, people who are like seen to be like the real authors of film. The only problem with this list was like it was all just like white male directors, so not great. And the directors of Guild America also tried to kind of perpetuate this. You might have heard of an expression like one film, one person, or one film, one mind, where it's like the idea of there's this one person that rises above all the noise of production, and they kind of this vision of a film that they try to bring out to life. But honestly, you know, this also doesn't work because, like, what about the rest of production? There's screenwriters, there's camera people, there's actors, there's lighting assistants, there's all of these people. Maybe they should have a voice too, right? So later in 2002, Janet Steiger, she published a paper kind of challenging these ideas, trying to elevate the single author to several authors. And so she proposes six forms of authorship that we can think about. So first is authorship as origin, where like an author is a free agent, so like a person like me speaking here, I'm a person, so I have an authorship on whatever this speech is. Authorship as personality, so like the person has a personality and that can influence whatever they're creating. Authorship as sociology of production, so like where because you have a certain role in a film that will make you think in a certain way. So like a cinematographer is going to do cinematographer things. And then authorship as signature. So like this is more a structuralist approach where you might have trying to think about like how authors have certain styles that you can see across different films. Authorship as reading strategy. So this is about reading interpretation. So how does the audience you interpret whatever you're watching. And so in some sense, because of your experiences, you'll think of things differently. And so you're, in some sense, an author of the media. And then authorship as the technique of self, where, like in society, we have these societal norms. And usually this is about like how credits, we only list certain things on the credits. And so society views that these people are authors. It depends from country to country and depends from place to place. And so I saw all of this and I was like, you know what? I want to propose a seventh form of authorship, which is software. Or tools, but for liberal graphics, we'll say just software as an offer. So, out of curiosity, who has seen the film Flow? Less than I expected. You should go watch it if you haven't seen it yet. Does anyone know what shows up in the credits? There's a software that everyone knows. Someone just shouted out. Blender. Yes, Blender. And you know that is a form where. A software, if you're an open source lithographic software, has been credited as an author. So I want to give a quick story about how I saw it change me. So about 2.5 years ago, I took a motion graphics class, and being the rebel I was like, you know what, I'm going to never touch Adobe software. And I made it through the class without touching Adobe software. And eventually, nowadays, I try to make it my goal to only use free and open source software in my production workflows. And at the end of that semester in the motion graphics class, I decided to try something completely new, something I'd never done before, which was a project called Motion Canvas. And that's basically just a TypeScript library that exposes a UI that has a timeline, and so it makes it easy to like sync up your animations to audio while keeping like all the good stuff about like you know code, so like you can reuse objects, reuse animations, all that good stuff. And over time, I realized that by learning how to use that tool, it changed the way of how I saw production and film just normally. So instead of like thinking props, like on set, like physical props, I would see like, oh, these are actually just reusable components in a scene. Kind of sounds codish, but and a little bit cringe, maybe. But yeah, it actually like changed the way of how I thought things. And the FOSS ecosystem too. Like for example, with FOSS, you know, it's very easy to integrate different software in your workflow because everything runs on open standards and open file formats. So it's very easy to just like, you know, take SVG from Inkscape and then just import it directly into Blender, and boom, you now have an SVG in Blender. It's very easy, and like, this is almost like even better than Adobe's like ecosystem of saying, oh, we can import file formats. No, this just works. And so, yeah, over time, I realized that you know, software had really changed my mindset and the way that I think, approach, and even view the making of films. And so if there's a takeaway from this, I mean, I guess for developers, it would be this. So you can think about thank you first for making these awesome software tools, but you can think about how do those tools have an authorship in those in the creation of media that you use. And maybe that can help you find a direction to bring your project into. And to the users, I suggest maybe thinking about how does the software that you use influence your art, and how is it an offer in your art? And maybe that can help you find out, you know, what software you want to use and where to go. And so, yeah. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, it's all right. I'm mainly just going to talk. I just want to speak quickly about the Eclectic Tech Carnival and Sister Server. Yesterday morning in the session about the LGM, there was the list for other events and networks that we could maybe look at LGM being a track in. And I wrote down the ETC, Eclectic Tech Carnival, and then I realised actually it's the wrong way round. The ETC should be a track in the LGM because it's very much smaller and, if you can imagine, even more precarious than LGM is. And I don't know how many of you are even aware that it exists, so I think I would just say a little bit about it. This is something that grew out of the Gender Changer Academy in Amsterdam in the late 90s, which was I wasn't there, I wasn't part of it, but it was workshops for women who had the experience of going into hacker communities and feeling really excluded and sometimes experiencing quite negative negative experiences. So they thought, let's make our own group, and they started locally organising workshops for women that were for hardware and software. And then other women around Europe were hearing about it, and they had the idea to make it be a travelling event. So the first ETC was, I think, in 2001 in Pula in Croatia. And the first time I went was in 2004 in Belgrade. So it's a locally self-organised event. I don't know if you can read it because it's so small, but it says here it's a gathering of feminists who critically explore and develop everyday skills and information technologies in the context of free and open source software and hardware. Events are organised autonomously by local groups. The defining characteristics of an ETC are skill sharing with free and open source technology, Flinter-only workshops, and do-it-yourself. Flinter is the German term, if you're not familiar with it, that's like LGBTQI++, everything except cis men, basically. It began as a women-only thing, but over the years it has morphed as it's needed to into being more inclusive. And alongside the... Oh, it's so tiny, isn't it? The ETC, we have the Sister Server, which is a feminist server. And so it's a kind of a live experiment in running a server by feminists and with feminist kind of philosophy wrapped around everything that we do. I'm completely ungeeky when it comes to the server, but I'm on the mailing list and I see all this stuff coming through, and it's, to me, really, really interesting. We run Nextcloud, GitLab, Mastodon, mailing lists, PeerTube, technical docs, VPN zines, and the website also for the Eclectic Tech Carnival. And it's basically like anyone who's interested to get involved can get involved, and it's a learning environment is the idea behind it. And the Mastodon instance is one of the things that I'm using. So it's if people are part of the ETC and the Sister Server, they can have an account and we run that. We can decide what kind of who we want to federate with or not, how we want to moderate it, and we learn about how to do all of these things at the same time. And at the ETC, quite often what we're doing is opening up hardware and taking it apart and putting it back together and seeing if it works or not. And it's just a really great group of people that have been super supportive of each other over a really long period of time now. Of course, always new ones coming in, and it's a really diverse mix of people who are, like, we have one woman who's a VPN tunneling high expert. We have Gloria, our lead developer at Upstage, who also works for NASA in her day job. And then we have, like, there's one woman who's working with social organisations, there's me, there's all kinds of artists and people who are involved as well. So it's a really interesting network to be a part of. And I think there's a lot of crossovers with the LGM network as well, like people that are part of Servus and Moor.rt in Austria, people involved with Constance in Brussels. So there's lots of nice interweaving of the networks there. So that's the ETC and Sister Server.
So So hello, everyone. This is a very improvised presentation because I just found out I had a small slot recently. I'm here to talk a tiny bit about OpenRNDR. It's a creative coding framework I've been using for 5 years. It's about a bit also the story, maybe for those who do not consider them contributors, but maybe just, well, just is already a lot to be a user. It's not usually part of a plan, as many of those who are regular contributors will know. It just happens somehow. So I'm part of a creative code meetup group in Berlin. It's creativecode.berlin. And we've been organizing there more than 12 years, monthly meetups. These are some historic photographs of those events. And yeah, we have been archiving all of those our events over the years. This is from a longer presentation, so I'm going to try to jump over much of it. But this is OpenRNDR. So the website is openrndr.org. It's a creative coding framework which uses Kotlin. It's similar to Processing or Open Frameworks, if you heard about that, or others. So about five years ago, I just went to give it a try, and shortly after, maybe I found a bug or something, or maybe a typo, and I went to submit a pull request, and then another one, and another one, and now somehow it seems like I'm the second contributor to the framework. So be careful; it can happen to you. But I've been really enjoying it. I'll jump around a bit, different topics. One thing I'm proud about the OpenRNDR framework is the guide, which I've been maintaining lately. And it has an interesting thing, which is it has all these videos and images. Let me see if like that. This is just a web page. And it's because when you write the guide, you can write text for the person to understand, and also you can embed some code, and the code will generate automatically screenshots and videos. So it makes it very nice for people to understand. Like all those images you see there, they are generated automatically when we push the content to GitHub. So do I have 17 minutes? I thought I only had 10. Okay. So yeah, so this is really useful because as we are doing graphics and visual stuff, then it's really good to be able to automatically generate those things for the people to understand what the code does. And there's a lot of pages on the guide, and we are on the way to release version 0.4.5, so the guide is still referring to 0.4.4. So we still will have to add like 100 pages or something. But let me show you quickly, maybe, what is this, the guide. So there's the core framework, and all these OpenRNDR and the libraries it uses are packages you find in Sonatype in the Maven Central. So it's very modular. And there's a core part, and then there's this huge list, let me show you down here, which are the add-ons or extensions that you can use. There's things like MIDI, OSC, like to interface with different hardware. I don't know what it is either, math, like different algorithms like KD-trees or matching squares. There's all kind of things you may use. I recently pushed something which is not yet merged. This is the ORX Axitro. So for those who are into using pen plotters, then you can directly draw from your program into the pen plotter without needing to go through an intermediate step. And you can configure all the settings for the pen plotter directly in a GUI inside the program. Yeah, there's lots of add-ons, and they're called ORXs, like OpenRNDR Extra. And most of them, as far as I know, everything is like in functional state, so they are still running. So it's well maintained. The team is very small, so we are not many people writing. So if anyone wants to help, it would be amazing. But the reason such a small team has been able to maintain so many libraries and functionalities, a lot of thanks to automation. So we have a lot of scripts in GitHub, even if I'm not a fan of GitHub, but it's very useful, the CI part. So it takes care of building everything automatically and testing and generating the guide, the screenshots. Even here, which is the OpenRNDR, the extras, if you look at, let's look at one of them, maybe shade style. And it has also readmes, which are in part auto-generated. The internet. We know the internet here. So it has a lot of screenshots for all the possibilities each of these, or at least the extensions which produce visual output. Of course, you're not going to have screenshots of MIDI, but loaded. So you can see that, of course, there's a part we write on the top, but then there's a big folder full of demos of all the features of each extension, and then they are producing. Sometimes they're not the nicest. I mean, these are there to demonstrate functionality, so they're not maybe aesthetically the nicest. That's not a goal. But yeah, you can see then a lot of these demos, and then if you look, oh, how did they do that? Then you can just click on the source code and jump directly to see the code, and of course you can run it on your own computer. So that's a very quick overview. Let me see where we were of OpenRNDR, and I'm going to skip here. So the framework was released, I don't know if it's 5 or 6 years ago, by a studio in the Netherlands. I think the framework is older, maybe, I don't know, 10 or more years. But they decided to open source it, which was great for me and for anyone else who wants to use it. The studio is called RNDR. They're from The Hague. And they do pretty amazing audiovisual projects. You can find in their website, often related to data visualization and data science. Here are some examples. Let me jump over. This is an example of the syntax, how it looks like. So far, it's been ideal to write OpenRNDR programs in IntelliJ IDEA, because Kotlin, which is the language, is developed by the same people as the IDE, so it's very well integrated. And I guess I was showing here that the auto-completion is really amazing. Sometimes I just have to type the first letter of each, I don't know, keyword or function or something, and it will auto-complete. So you can go very fast translating your thoughts into shapes and movement and animation. Let me see, what else do I have? That was my first commit. I found it there. It's 2020, 5 years ago. And one thing led to the other thing, so then I started to discuss with a friend online, and we started to make videos, which are called In Conversation. I hosted them in PeerTube, in a platform called TubeEdu, which contains a lot of educational content. And so there we started recording a lot of our conversations, explaining the things we found interesting about the framework. This you can see some of examples I'm always sketching and experimenting with different visuals and different ideas. The small experiments then sometimes lead to larger projects, which I think I'm displaying somewhere at the end. So it's a very capable project, framework. You can see here some of the works which are pen plotter based, so these are all, it's very easy to generate SVG files. Or you can also easily create programs that open an SVG file, manipulate it in some way, and save a modified version. Yeah, this is all Pernplotter. There's lots of experiments. And I wanted to show you some more pixel-based stuff, which is maybe here. You can do things like with compute shaders. So these are like simulations with like a million particles or something that's very, is it plain right now? Is it very slowly moving? So it's barely noticeable. So it's an artwork I showed in Berlin. What other kind of things you can do? Well, here you have some experiments with animation. And I think I'll end with some final works. So this was recently exhibited in Berlin in a small gallery. And yeah, I'm here in, should be near the end. So yeah, if anyone is curious and wants to experiment, it's openrndr.org. You will find me in the forum answering if anyone has questions. thank you.
Minus five, okay, three. okay. So I'll be quick. You may know me by Font Bakery. I would like to say that we recently released Font Spector, which is a re-implementation into Rust. But this is not what I'm here to talk about in 3 minutes. I'm here to talk about not about my professional free software work, but by my free time, leisure time free software work. So I really love MAME, which is a free software implementation of emulators for many video game machines, arcades. But also, one thing that not many people know is that MAME also emulates physical devices, like old computers and even weird like video multiplexer effects panels like this. But in order to emulate that, instead of just showing the image that you would see on a screen, you have to show LEDs and 7-segment displays. So there is an internal layout system, like it's an XML file that describes the position of the labels, the position of the LEDs, and the 7-segment displays and buttons. And it creates this generic-looking the interface that resembles the original interface of the device, but without the branding, without the actual physical thing. So there's a secondary way to represent this, which is with an external layout. The external layout is also described by an XML file, but it can include the most basic thing, it can include a photo. So I was supposed to stop to speak now. So this is the most basic, just a photo with the synthetic elements on top, and the runtime of the emulation will have generate signals that turn on and off these synthetic elements on top of the photo. This is the most basic one. But there's a little bit more advanced system, which is based on actually, it's the same. It's just a different technique, which is you can draw a vector representation of the interface and then just load it as PNG because the SVG renderer is not so good. So in the end, even if drawing with SVG, I end up exporting a high-resolution PNG. So other than being a nerd for computers, I'm also a musician, and I had this device when I was a kid, and I decided that I wanted to emulate this device. It's basically a musical keyboard with a big VGA controller, LCD color screen. So when you emulate these things on MAME, you get just the video, just like in this arcade. This is the video of the arcade, but the real thing is like a physical machine. In the case of the keyboard, I have it running here. This is the SVG on Inkscape, and this is the thing actually running on MAME, so you just see the screen. And it's broken because the emulator is not complete. There's some hardware that was not properly emulated, so you just see an error message for now. But anyway, you see what shows up on the screen. But if you go to the menus, you can select the internal layout, which is that weird but functional, ugly but functional, or you can actually have the external layout, which is beautiful. And you can click and operate the device, and if the emulator was complete, it would actually react because button presses change states in the emulation, right? And for the future, I envision that even for these devices that nowadays are only emulated like that, you only see the screen of the video game, I envision that in the system, in the future, you would see the system as 3D models reacting to the signals that controls the motors, because there were actual motor controllers, right? And applies on the surface of the CRT, applies whatever was the bitmap output of the emulation, right? So, yeah, this has been proposed, but it's not implemented yet. And this system, you can see it running. Oh, where is it? It's here. Yep. So, like, you have a music module, and you can actually click and operate it, like, utils, and navigate here to demo, and enter, play the demo, and there will be sound. And that's the end.